Okay, so following the textbook of Mukhanov and Vinitsky, I give you now in this and the next two or so lectures a quick preview of quantum fields, and then we go into it in full detail later on, so that we are ready then to do it on curved space-time for the purpose of cosmology and black holes. Okay, so a quick thing about quantum fields, a taste of quantum fields. Let me start with the intuition. This is a picture of the surface of a lake, and it's just regular waves. We are used to thinking of waves as a phenomenon described by partial differential equations, and there's a certain mindset that we have when thinking about waves. I'd like to tweak that mindset a little bit and give you a particular perspective on what wave phenomena are that will be particularly useful for quantum field theory. Let us take such a water surface and imagine you probe what the waves are doing at one point. Okay, and we can do that by putting a piece of cork, for example, into the water there. So the cork is not going to move sideways or in any other direction. It's only going to move up and down. And as the cork goes up and down, it traces the waves that are going through that point. So what we see here is that the cork goes up and down in some irregular fashion, but overall it's some oscillatory motion, right? Some oscillatory motion. And here is how it might look like. Okay, that's just as a function of time, the height, the elevation of the cork as a function of time. So what we have at any point on this lake is some kind of oscillator. Some kind of oscillator that goes up and down in some fashion. We can place several corks into that lake. Let's say one here, one there, one there, one there. Let's say four of them. And each one of them will give us some sort of timeline of what the amplitude of the wave is at each one of the locations of a cork. So with multiple corks, this might be the curves, the elevation curves over time for those, for let's say four different corks. And the blue one would be the one that we had initially. It turns out that the first cork is some kind of oscillator, so is the second, so is the third, so is the fourth. And those oscillators go up and down in some, in general, irregular fashion, but they're going to be correlated. What one cork is doing is going to be impacted by what the other corks are doing and impacting them. Or at least there is a correlation, right? I'm not saying causation, but correlation. Of course, we know there's also causation. If you grab hold of a cork and you swing it up and down, this will, in fact, also, sooner or later, impact the others because waves will propagate. But let's think of it in terms of oscillators. In terms of oscillators, we have, with the four corks, four oscillators that are coupled to each other. Okay? And there is a way to think of a field, a quantum field, similar to the surface of water, as consisting of an infinite collection of oscillators. At every point, there's an oscillator which can go up and down. And these oscillators are coupled to each other. They're coupled oscillators. You can probe them with the corks. And later on in the course, we will see what kind of instrument you can use to probe a quantum field, just as if you were putting a cork in it. So we will have to deal with systems of oscillators in quantum field theory. And as you can imagine, they're going to be quantum oscillators. In the case of water waves, those oscillators are not harmonic oscillators. It turns out that there's a lot of nonlinearity in water waves. In quantum field theory, strictly speaking, from all we know of the Standard Model of Particle Physics, the harmonic oscillators of quantum fields are not harmonic either. And the reason is that they have three and four vertices, and they introduce, I mean, we will get later to what that means, three and four vertices, that introduce nonlinearities in the interaction, in the self-interaction even of a field. And so in quantum field theory, the quantum fields are not really consisting of harmonic oscillators. But to a very good approximation, they do consist of harmonic oscillators. And the non-harmonicity is treated perturbatively as what is called interaction or self-interaction. Free quantum fields always consist of just harmonic oscillators. However, coupled harmonic oscillators. Because with quantum fields, just like with water waves, if you tickle them at one point, this will have an effect in the neighborhood. This spreading means that the harmonic oscillator sitting here is not independent from a harmonic oscillator over there, but there will be coupling terms that communicate between them. All right, so clearly we will have to study harmonic oscillators. So let me recall just the basics of harmonic oscillators and indicate already what aspects of them will be important for quantum fields. Then we'll go to relativistic quantum fields, perform the second quantization that I mentioned last lecture already. And then we'll look a little bit into harmonic oscillators, into the harmonic oscillators that occur inside fields and the role of their vacuum fluctuations. So we come back to that image, but the quantum field version of it. All right, so let's start with harmonic oscillators. You all know the harmonic oscillator Hamiltonian looks like this. By suitable reparametrization, we can always bring it in that form where there's just p squared over 2m and then omega squared half q squared, where q is the position variable. The equations of motion are simply those two equations where the relationship between the canonically conjugate momentum and the time derivative of the position will be treated as is the norm, actually, will be treated as another equation of motion. So it's not, don't view it necessarily as a definition, you can view it as an equation of motion. We have two first order in time differential equations, which are equivalent to one second order differential equation. They are mathematically speaking on the same level, even though this equation is often introduced as a definition. By the way, when we look at the quantum harmonic oscillators that are contained in fields, then it would be very similar. I think I indicated to you in the previous lecture already that we will consider the field phi and its time derivative as its canonically conjugate momentum field. But that's only true in Minkowski space. It turns out that when it gets interesting, when we have an expanding space-time or curvature, horizons, black holes, and so on, then the canonically conjugate field to phi is not just the time derivative. It will be more complicated. And we'll have to find out how to derive what is the canonically conjugate field. It's very important because you need it, you need the proper definition to get the proper commutation relations. Anyway, so at this stage, this is the Hamiltonian. These are the equations of motion. And I didn't have to specify whether this was classical or quantum physics. The same is true in classical as in quantum physics. Now, what is the lowest energy solution in classical physics? This will be important for field theory, because if you think about the waves, waves consisting of harmonic oscillators, the lowest energy solution would be where the lake is completely flat, no oscillations. The harmonic oscillators are in their resting position, like here. So that's the potential of the harmonic oscillator at the resting position. Obviously, the lowest energy solution classically is having energy equals zero. And in this case, we know that nothing moves, and we know that for sure. That's the ground state of the classical harmonic oscillator. Quantum mechanically, of course, this thing changes. As always, when we are quantizing, the equations of motion remain unchanged, of course, as we said already. And the canonically conjugate pairs of variables are now no longer commuting. So the Hamiltonian is still this, the equations of motion are still those, but the commutator is this one. And as we discussed in the previous lecture, this means that Q and P can no longer be number valued. They have to take their values in something that's non-commutative. Now, in mathematics, you can cook up a lot of objects that are not commuting with each other. For example, geometric operations, matrices, operators, and so on. And there is a theorem, the Stone-Von-Neumann theorem, that says that these commutation relations have a essentially unique representation on a Hilbert space, and all other, seemingly other representations are actually unitarily equivalent to each other. They differ only by a change of basis in the Hilbert space. So we will find that we will find the Qs, so you have found already in previous courses, the Q and the P of T as functions of time that are operator valued. And so it is with all of the observables, with H and all the operators that occur, of course. Now, what is the lowest energy solution in this case? In the quantum case, the lowest energy state, let's call it psi naught, is an eigenstate to the Hamiltonian, and the eigenvalue is 1/2 h bar omega. Which means that the energy is elevated from what it was classically, where it was zero. If you're sitting at the bottom of the potential, the energy is zero, but now it's elevated. How come? Let's look at this a little bit more closely, because for quantum fields, again, this is going to be important. The harmonic oscillators in the quantum fields are going to have some ground state energy too. And each one of those oscillators is going to contribute an amount which takes that form. Technically, all of those ground state energies will actually add up to infinity. So it's a real problem, and therefore let's get to that carefully. Okay, so why is it that the lowest energy state of the quantum harmonic oscillator is not zero? This will be important for understanding vacuum energy and its role in cosmology later on. Okay, so let us consider, in order to get a hold of the lowest energy eigenstate, let us consider the eigenbasis of the position operator. So the Q vectors are improper eigenvectors of the position operator. I'm calling them improper because they're not really in the Hilbert space, because they're not square integrable. They obey this eigenvector equation, and we continuum normalize them in this way, of course. Then the overlap between the ground state of the harmonic oscillator and the position eigenvectors gives us the position wave function of the ground state of the harmonic oscillator. And I hope you're all completely familiar with this. If not, let me know, and I can give you some lecture notes of a quantum mechanics course that I taught. So remember, the overall structure is that if you have a state of a quantum theory, if you have a state of a quantum theory and you want to know its wave function, then you calculate the overlap between the state in question and all of the basis vectors of the representation that you're interested in this case the position representation, and these complex numbers form the wave function. That is a completely general statement. It has nothing to do with this being position eigenvectors. You could choose any eigenbasis you want, any operator's eigenbasis. You could, for example, take that state and then consider, I don't know, the fifth power of the Hamiltonian, self-adjoint operator. You can diagonalize it. You get an eigenbasis. And you could choose here, instead of the position eigenbasis, the eigenbasis of the fifth power of the Hamiltonian. Or let's say angular momentum or whatever, right? You take an eigenbasis of any self-adjoint operator, and then you get these overlap coefficients. They form then the wave function of that abstract state for that particular representation. So if you take the fifth power of the Hamiltonian, then the wave function that you get is the fifth power Hamiltonian eigenbasis wave function. Okay, so the relationship between wave functions here and states over there is that you take the overlap with the eigenbasis of some operator. Later on, when we will do a similar thing for quantum field theory, it's the same logic, but way more abstract. It's harder to understand, as you will find out then. So I hope this is completely clear. Then from the usual treatment of quantum harmonic oscillators, you probably remember that this is how this wave function looks like, the wave function of the of the lowest energy eigenstate of the harmonic oscillator. It looks like this. It has a Gaussian behavior. It goes down like e to the power minus q squared. That's just the normalization of it. And the point is, it's a Gaussian. The higher the frequency of the harmonic oscillator, the narrower is the Gaussian. Because the larger the omega is, the more quickly will this exponential decay. So keep in mind, the higher the frequency, the narrower is the Gaussian. That plays a huge role when it comes to renormalization in quantum field theory, quantum fluctuations. Everything is affected by that. So here's a sketch of the wave function of the ground state of the harmonic oscillator. Again, the higher the frequency of the harmonic oscillator, the more peaked is this Gaussian, which means the more likely is it to find the position to be close to zero. So the higher, the larger the frequency of the harmonic oscillator is, the smaller is going to be the likely elongation of the harmonic oscillator if we measure its position. Whereas if the frequency is very low, then you get a broader Gaussian there, and so you have a larger probability of finding the elongation a little bit further out. But still, overall, it's Gaussian cutoff. I mean, it goes down very quickly, faster than exponentially, because it goes quadratically there. Now, let's reconsider what has happened to the resting position of the harmonic oscillator. Classically, the resting position was the oscillator is at zero and stays there, and we know that for sure. For fields, it means that if the lake is completely quiet and there's no wave on it, then that's it. There's no oscillation going on, and it's just at its lowest energy, and that is it for the lake. But in the lowest energy state of a quantum harmonic oscillator, things are different. The expectation value of the position is still zero, right? If you calculate the expectation value of this, well, there's as much on the right as there is on the left. So the expectation value of the position is zero, but there are quantum fluctuations. The variance is not zero. The variance is given by this. So if this is the potential, here is the Gaussian. And so what we see is that the probability distribution for where the particle is likely to be found is spread out. And now we get an intuition for why the ground state energy is elevated above zero. It's basically because the particle explores not just the classical resting position, but the particle is actually exploring, is virtually, with a significant probability, also quite some distance to the left, quite some distance to the right, because the Gaussian is flat up here, right? So it actually gives a finite probability, an appreciable probability for finding the particle elsewhere, not at x equals zero. But elsewhere, there is potential. In other words, the particle is fluctuating up and down the potential, and therefore it's picking up that the potential is not zero out there. And that is the contribution of the 1/2 h bar omega. You see, it's completely intuitive and foundational that there ought to be an elevation of the energy level because of that. All the more, it is fascinating that in the case of quantum fields, as we will see later, that intuition seems to fail. In quantum field theory, we would derive the same thing. We would come to the conclusion that the vacuum energy ought to be elevated. In fact, it ought to be tremendously elevated because there are so many harmonic oscillators involved. But experimentally, we can measure that energy because it contributes to the Einstein equation. There seems to be such a ground state energy, but it's 120 orders of magnitude smaller than we would expect from just adding up the ground state energies of those harmonic oscillators. Huge mystery. We will get to that in more detail later on. For now, let's just say, straightforwardly, ordinary quantum harmonic oscillators have an elevated ground state energy for obvious reasons, at least seemingly obviously reasons. So in our four-point plan, we did point one. We recalled harmonic oscillators. Now let's get into relativistic fields. Our task is to make the Schrödinger equation relativistically covariant. So here's the Schrödinger equation. And it contains here the Laplacian. This triangle stands for the sum from I equal 1 to 3, sum over the second derivatives. For now, it does. Later on, when we deal with quantum field theory and curved space-time, the Laplacian will be a more general expression. But for now, on flat space, that's what it is. As we discussed briefly in the previous lecture, there are two ways to make that covariant. Based on the observation that we have only one time derivative and two space derivatives here, we can either try to drop a derivative here and turn this into an equation that's first order not only in time derivatives but also in space derivatives. If you do that, you will need something covariant to contract with this first derivative vector, right? There's a vector of d by dt, d by dx1, d by dx2, d by dx3. That vector needs to be contracted with something in order to give you a nice scalar equation. And there is no such vector in special relativity. So Dirac made one up. And that's the vector of the gamma 0, gamma 1, gamma 2, gamma 3 matrix. Matrices, and they can be contracted with that, and you end up with a Dirac equation if you do this. Now, in this course, we will not go that path, but instead we'll go the Klein-Gordon path. And they said, clearly, in order to get covariance, we need to have the same number of time derivatives as of space derivatives. Otherwise, this is never going to work out with Lorentz transformations, which mix space and time in a more or less democratic way. So they said, let's cook up an equation that has second derivatives. And here's how you can naturally arrive at that. Remember from first quantization, from ordinary quantum mechanics, that the momentum operator can be represented on position wave functions in this way, as minus I h bar times the spatial derivative. And the energy can be represented as I h bar times the time derivative. Right? Because that's what the Schrödinger equation is. It says that the energy is equal to I h bar times the time derivative. So with these definitions, the motion of a free particle is described by the Schrödinger equation in this way. So now this is not a number. It is this operator here, which is energy operator that's represented like this. Okay, so we have this relationship between the energy and the p squared over 2m. This is clearly a non-relativistic equation. It simply is the expression that the kinetic energy is 1/2 m derivative squared. Clearly non-relativistic. Special relativity has also an equation of that kind, but it has second powers in the energy as well. It has a second power in the energy as well. The special relativistic generalization of that equation, of the kinetic energy equation, is this one. Right? Special relativity says that energy squared minus momentum squared is equal to mass squared up to factors of c squared to get the units right. Right? It says that the length of the four momentum vector is given by m squared. The length squared of the four momentum vector is given by m squared. That is the special relativistic equation. That is the one that is covariant under Lorentz transformations. And the succinct way of writing this is to say that P mu, and we are summing over mu, of course, because it's a twice occurring index, P mu is m squared c to the fourth. Okay, so this is what we have from the Schrödinger equation, but that is what special relativity seems to demand, said Klein and Gordon. So they said, well, we learned from quantum mechanics that we should represent the P this way and the E that way. Can do. So let's plug these into that equation, and then you obtain that this turns into second time derivatives over here, and that becomes second space derivatives here, the Laplacian, and then we just carry that forward. So they said, bang, here you have it. Relativistic quantum mechanics. That is the Klein-Gordon equation. And it is usually written in this way. So we said that we measure velocities in multiples of the speed of light. Therefore, c is equal to 1. And then this equation becomes that equation. We also measure actions in multiples of the Planck constant, so h bar is then also equal to 1. There's an even shorter way of writing down the Klein-Gordon equation, and that is to combine these two operators, the second time derivative and the sum of the second space derivatives, into the box operator or the D'Alembertian. This is how the D'Alembertian looks like, how the box operator looks like on flat space. In curved space time, it will be a little bit more complicated. And we will have to find out how to derive what it is. Now let's check that the non-relativistic limit is okay. So let us see in which sense the Klein-Gordon equation reduces to the Schrödinger equation for small momenta. That should work out. Not trivial though. So let's say that the Klein-Gordon equation holds. So let's say that that equation holds. Instead of writing it in terms of the operators, written as differential operators, I'm writing them more abstractly, just like in quantum mechanics, you can write the P not necessarily as a space derivative, there are other representations of the momentum operator and so on. So this is representation independently. So in that representation independent way of writing the Klein-Gordon equation, we now take the square root of it, and then we obtain that E is plus or minus of this. And you see there's already a bit of a problem because it's not unique. If we take the square root of it, we get a positive and we get a negative square root. So we seem to be on the right track because if you remember, the Schrödinger equation takes this form, E equal to P squared over 2m. So E equal to something, that is the Schrödinger equation. The Klein-Gordon equation looks like this with the E squared. So by taking the square root, we were making a step towards the Schrödinger equation. But we run into an ambiguity, right? So we took the Klein-Gordon equation multiplied with c squared, and then took the square root of it, the left-hand side and of the right-hand side, then we get e equal to something, but it's not quite the Schrödinger right-hand side, and there's a plus and a minus. It turns out that the plus will correspond to particles and the minus to antiparticles. Plus corresponds to positive energies and minus to particles with negative energies. So we choose, because we want to describe the Schrödinger equation situation with particles that have positive energies, we choose the positive sign here, and well knowing that we are now throwing away half of the solutions. One moment, please. And so that's what we get. Yep.
So E here is an operator on different space, right?
It depends. Remember that the momentum operator in the position representation is a derivative operator. The momentum operator in the momentum representation is just a multiplication operator. The momentum operator in the Fock representation is a complicated matrix. So I was thinking of it as representation independently. If you do want to make sense of it explicitly, you might want to go into the eigenbasis of the operator, where you can then take a square root by taking the square root of the eigenvalue.
Okay, okay. But that's not the only square root you could have.
Yes, it's not unique.
Yeah, it could have many other square roots.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, that's right. Yes, because it's an operator, that's right. So we have this equation now, which is not quite the equation of the Schrödinger equation. Let us do a Taylor expansion for small values of p squared, for small momenta, therefore small velocities, or in other words, for large relative speeds of light. In this case, when we do a Taylor expansion, we get, you see, the lowest order term is just this, square root of m squared c to the fourth. That's mc squared. And you recognize that business, right? E equal mc squared. And then you get extra terms. You get this term and higher order terms. And it turns out that the leading order term after the mc squared, which is the rest mass of a particle, is just the p squared over 2m. And then there are higher order terms. So, by the way, we have now just rederived E equal mc squared. And we rederived that the first order contribution to the kinetic energy is quadratic in P, but we now also know how to get the higher order relativistic corrections. For example, there's another term now with P to the fourth in principle that you may want to take into account. All right, so what we find is indeed the equation of the Schrödinger equation, except there's an extra mc squared. So for small momenta, the Klein-Gordon equation becomes the Schrödinger equation in a somewhat vague sense, because we did it for operators and treated it as if it was for numbers. And the only difference is that we get this equation, which has the mc squared in it. So our Schrödinger equation, we just derived as a special case, as a limiting case of small momenta from the Klein-Gordon equation, is this one. And there's this extra term mc squared. So the Hamiltonian of a free particle is then not simply p squared over 2m, but also p squared over 2m plus mc squared, where this is just adding to the energy of the particle. And that's multiplying with the identity operator here. Yeah, I mean, I'm writing it as if it was a number here. But of course, when we're dealing with operators, then whenever we write just a number, what we really mean is a number times the identity operator. It turns out that in quantum mechanics, this term doesn't matter. And that's because the equations of motion look like this. The time derivative of any operator is given by the commutator of that operator or observable with the Hamiltonian. And if you add a constant to it, a constant times the identity operator, well, it doesn't show up in the commutator, because anything, any number times the identity operator commutes with our observable. Therefore, the equations of motion are completely unaffected by the addition of something that multiplies the identity operator. So it doesn't matter in quantum mechanics if you shift the overall energy of your system by any amount you want, if it's constant. That's not the case in general relativity, as you will see, because energy can't help but gravitate. So in principle, there ought to be a contribution from the mc squared term as well. And there for sure is. Now, a few remarks are in order. First of all, the negative energy solutions that we dropped in this derivation spoil the interpretation of the field psi of x and t as a wave function. It is no longer describing a probability amplitude density for finding a particle at a particular location. Not for lack of trying. People have tried very hard to obtain an interpretation of relativistic quantum mechanics in the same way that the Schrödinger wave function has a clean interpretation in the sense of the probability amplitude squared being the probability density for finding a particle at that location. There is no such interpretation, and in fact has been shown there cannot be. This problem is deep, and eventually the attempt to do relativistic quantum mechanics, relativistic first quantization, was given up, therefore, and quantum field theory was developed, where these issues can be resolved. In particular, the negative energy solutions will not be swept under the rug. They simply propagate backwards in time. They have negative energy, but they propagate backwards in time, which means that for us, they look as if they were propagating forwards in time and have positive energy. It turns out that for some species of particles, their antiparticles are indistinguishable from their particles. So for example, the photon is its own antiparticle, and also, as it turns out, for the Klein-Gordon field, the quanta of the Klein-Gordon field are also their own antiparticles of the neutral Klein-Gordon field, the real-valued or self-adjoint operator-valued Klein-Gordon field. I should also say that there are many more ways to generalize the Schrödinger equation to obtain relativistic covariant equations of motion. For example, there must be a way to generalize it to obtain an equation of motion for photons. Of course, that's going to be the Maxwell equations. You don't even have to do anything to them. In principle, they still hold the same way that Maxwell wrote them down, just for operator-valued fields then. There is a difficulty arising because it's a gauge theory, but in principle, the same equations of motion still hold. And there are yet other species of particles. At the time, there was a time, I suppose in the 40s, when physicists were wondering, so how many different, how do we know which is the right equation of motion for spin 3/2 particles, for example? Maybe there are a huge kind of different equations of motion that could do it. Or spin 5/2 particles. There are no fundamental spin 5/2 particles, but there are composite particles that have spin 5/2. So the issue comes up. Now it turns out that Wigner figured it out, and he did a complete classification of the spins and other external quantum numbers that particles can have, such as mass and helicity, and the wave equations that go along with that. So Wigner found that the possibilities are, by studying the Poincaré group, the representations of the Poincaré group, he found that there are standard wave equations for the various spins. In particular, for spin 0, there's the Klein-Gordon equation, and it describes particles such as the Higgs particle, the inflaton particle, and, for example, composite particles such as the pi mesons. For spin 1/2, there's the Dirac equation, and there are small variations of that for massless cases. For example, to describe neutrinos, electrons, quarks, but also composite particles such as protons and neutrons. And then there are the Maxwell equations for spin 1 that describes photons and gluons. Gluons obey something like the Maxwell equations, but a little bit more complicated because they have an extra extra index for isospin, and that modifies the equations of motion such that there's a nonlinearity. Photons can't directly interact with each other, but gluons can. They see each other. They are charged. Wigner also looked at higher spins. Higher spin particles do not occur as fundamental particles, as far as we know. I mean, not higher spin than spin 1. And that is plausible. There is a nice reason for why nature may have confined itself to using only spin 0, spin 1/2, and spin 1 particles. And the reason is that, from all we know, higher spin theories can be formulated but not renormalized. It seems that in 3 plus 1 dimensions, this is the cutoff. In lower dimensions, you could quantize higher spin. In higher dimensions than 3 plus 1, you could only quantize lower spin. It seems that in 3 plus 1 dimensions, that's the threshold. So it's all very plausible. Yeah, nature could use fundamental spin 380 particles, but it doesn't because it wouldn't be a renormalizable theory. And renormalizable, I'll say more about renormalizable later in the course, but it basically means if a theory is not what is called renormalizable, then it loses predictive power. You need to specify an infinite number of unknown coefficients to even make the theory well-defined. However, that argument has a flaw. It works all very well in Minkowski space, but it turns out that once you allow for space-time to be curved, the issue arises what the quantization is of perturbations of the curvature of space-time. If you put a dent into space-time, then you create ripples, as if you were throwing a stone into a lake. And those ripples, those gravitational waves, should, when you quantize them, when you linearize gravity, and then you get wave equations, and you analyze what kind they are, according to Wigner's classification, they're spin 2. So that's a problem. One is that it spoils our argument that nature is not using higher than spin 1 particles because of non-renormalizability. Because if gravity is quantized in nature, then it's quantized spin 2 particles. And secondly, we have no idea how to actually do it. We don't really know how to do a quantum theory of gravity that has predictive power. It's not renormalizable. We need an infinite number of coefficients to even specify the theory. All right, so now we talked about the Klein-Gordon equation as if it were a relativistic version of the Schrödinger equation. One moment. The next step is to say, okay, let's forget about first quantization. Now we do the quantum field theory of the Klein-Gordon equation. Yes?
Just a small question about the spins. So how can you see the spin from the equation of motion? For instance, the Klein-Gordon equation.
Well, you have to go into the representation theory of the Poincaré group. That's a little bit beyond what I wanted to cover here. But I can give you literature on that after the lecture, if you like. Okay, so now let's do second quantization. We will here only quantize the Klein-Gordon equation. For justification, it's the easiest one, but the easiest one to quantize. And it's getting hard enough to do that on curved space. Really, nobody knows how to do QCD on curved space, for example. Just nobody knows how to even get that properly started. It's very, very difficult to do. But secondly, it's not only the easiest. Luckily, it's also apparently the only case of cosmological significance. So we are lucky that in this case, it's the easy field theory that we can get away with for cosmology. It seems that a Klein-Gordon field was responsible for all the action in the very early universe, namely the inflatron field. From now on, we will switch from the notation of psi, which originated in the Schrödinger which was from the Schrödinger equation, to a notation of phi for the field. So the psi was Schrödinger wave function. Now the phi is a field. And that's to indicate that we are switching fully into second quantization mode. And we no longer want to interpret this now in terms of, you know, the modulus square being a probability for probability density for finding a particle there. That's not what it is. The degrees of freedom are those of a field. And what a particle is, we will have to find out afresh. In non-relativistic quantum mechanics, it was easy. You just took the modulus squared of psi and you get the probability density for finding the particle there. For a quantum field phi, that interpretation is completely spoiled, and we will have to come up with a new mechanism to extract particle information from a quantum field. It's not as easy as just taking the modulus squared. It's a much more complicated process. And there are two ways to do it, and we will cover both ways. Anyway, so this thing will be called a field and not a wave function. So we have a field, phi of x and t, that obeys the Klein-Gordon equation. And then we also consider its canonically conjugate field, pi, which in Minkowski space-time can be taken to be simply the time derivative of phi. Just like in ordinary first quantization, where if x is the degree of freedom, then p is x dot, or q dot. So now the Klein-Gordon equation can be rewritten in this form. So it's now phi double dot minus Laplacian phi plus m squared equal to 0. This is phi double dot because pi is phi dot. And the point of putting the pi in there instead of the phi dot is, of course, that we will later want to use canonical commutation relations between phi and pi. So we replace occurrences of phi dot by pi. Okay, so that wasn't very difficult to replace the old way of writing the Klein-Gordon equation by this new way of writing it using the canonically conjugate momentum. Another thing that is worth pointing out about the Klein-Gordon equation is that it does not couple the real part of the field phi to the complex part of the field phi, to the imaginary part of the field phi, unlike the Schrödinger equation. The Schrödinger equation couples the real part to the imaginary part. In fact, there's explicitly an I in the Schrödinger equation. Right? So it turns what used to be real into imaginary, couples them. The Klein-Gordon equation doesn't do that. In other words, if you have a real solution, a real valued solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, you can multiply it with I, and it's still a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. And you can also take two real-valued solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation and multiply each one with a complex number, add them up, and they're again a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. So it's a linear differential equation because the phi occurs only in its first power. And therefore, you have additivity of solutions. The solutions form a vector space. In fact, we will later find how we can give this vector space an inner product as well, the space of solutions. It will be very important for quantization. Well, and it doesn't care about mixing the real and the imaginary parts. This is convenient for us because it means we can restrict attention to real-valued Klein-Gordon fields, and then we can get everything about complex-valued Klein-Gordon fields simply by linear combination. It turns out that real valued Klein-Gordon fields, when quantized, will describe neutral particles, whereas complex valued Klein-Gordon fields, when quantized, will describe charged Klein-Gordon fields. Well, let me put it the other way. If you work with electromagnetism, therefore the Maxwell equations, plus the Klein-Gordon equation in order to describe electrons, so if you use the Maxwell equations to describe photons, and you describe charged particles, such as, let's say, pions, using the Klein-Gordon equation, then you need to use the complex Klein-Gordon equation to describe those charged scalar particles. We will later see why that is. But for now, let's just keep in mind that if we're just studying the Klein-Gordon equation, it is sufficient to consider its real-valued solutions because complex-valued ones are just linear combinations of real-valued ones, complex linear combinations of them. Now, how do we go from first quantization to second quantization? Well, the Klein-Gordon equation is still to hold true because the general rule applies that in the Heisenberg picture, the equations of motion don't change from classical to quantum. So the Klein-Gordon equation should still hold even when the field is then operator valued. So now our field amplitudes are operator valued. It's as if, coming back to this picture of the lake at the beginning, the cork's height, right, that is measured by phi, and that becomes quantum now. Right? So at every point x of the lake, there is an amplitude, there's a height to be measured, that's our phi, and that's quantum now. It's an operator now. So what makes our Klein-Gordon theory now a second quantized theory is that we impose canonical commutation relations between the field and its canonically conjugate momentum field. And they are equal time commutation relations, which say that the pi at the location x prime equal to x is the canonically conjugate momentum to phi, and the pi at locations x prime that are not equal to x, that pi is not related to that phi. They don't want to know anything about each other. And you can see that from the right-hand side, only when x is equal to x prime, you get that this Dirac delta is having a peak. And otherwise, the phi and the pi simply commute. The phi and the pi at different locations simply commute. The phis, just like the positions in quantum mechanics, also commute always, and so do the pi. So let's just compare that with ordinary quantum mechanics, first quantization. There we have the canonical commutation relations between the q's and the p's, and let's say we have several different q's. For example, for different particles, or it's the three components of one particle. Then only when we're dealing with exactly the same degree of freedom do we have a non-zero commutator. And whenever it's not exactly the same degree of freedom, for example, it could be the same particle but a different coordinate, then they're commuting, or it could be different particles. And the position operators are always commuting, and so are the momentum operators. Similar here. And you see, even though it's a completely different circumstance, the mass is completely in analogy. Here, the q's are different degrees of freedom. Never mind that there are position degrees of freedom in first quantization. Let's just say there are some degrees of freedom, meaning something that can change over time. The q's are something that can change over time, and they are labeled by A. For every different A, you get a different degree of freedom, right? And here, it's for the phi, and they are labeled by x. At every position x, we have one of those corks that bobs up and down in the water. So for every x, we have a field amplitude phi that bobs up and down. That's the degree of freedom, and it has a canonically conjugate momentum degree of freedom. That is, for every location in the lake, there is another momentum of that that's canonically conjugates to the amplitude at x. Okay, so just like this A is labeling degrees of freedom, is counting through the degrees of freedom, here the x is labeling the degrees of freedom. So no wonder that the degrees of freedom at different locations are commuting with each other. They don't see each other, they're completely independent of another. Let me ask you this. What if I chose those two t's not at equal time? What if this t is a later time than that t? Do we still have that they commute? What would you guess? Was it necessary to require here equal time? Any guesses?
Depends on whether they're correlated.
In general. So the thing is, it is important. You see, if t is a much later time than, if this t is a much later time than that, then they are not independent. And as you said, then they are correlated, right? You can imagine it this way. Imagine you have the lake and there are two quarks. And you are looking at what one quark is doing, and then you're looking what the other quark is doing much later. And clearly, what the one quark did can give you some indication for what the other quark will do later on, if it's sufficiently late, if the waves had enough time to actually propagate to the second quark. In other words, if these two events are time-like to each other, if this is in the future light cone of that event, then in general they don't commute. And if, however, this event is still space-like to that one. You see, at equal time but different space, two events must always be space-like to each other. They cannot influence each other. And that shows up by them being commuting with each other. But as soon as the distance between the two events becomes time-like, the commutator can become non-zero. And the same for the canonically for this momenta, of course, as well. Okay, so it's important to do this at equal time. In all of this, it's not supposed to be obvious why this is going to be covariant after all. But as we will find out later, the whole thing is covariant. Okay, so on top of imposing these canonical commutation relations, we will keep the equations of motion. The equations of motion being that pi is phi dot, and that pi dot is this, which boils down to the Klein-Gordon equation. There's one more thing that we have to keep track of, a third thing. I mean, the first thing was impose commutation relations. Second was impose the equations of motion. And the third one is impose the hermeticity condition. Remember, we said that it suffices to restrict attention to real-valued Klein-Gordon fields, because the Klein-Gordon equation treats the real and the imaginary part completely separate. So if we know how to solve the real-valued Klein-Gordon equation, we know how to solve it in general. So we restrict attention to real-valued Klein-Gordon fields, which means phi star is phi at all x and t. But what's the quantum version of this? The quantum version is that we impose a hermeticity condition. So on top of imposing the commutators, on top of imposing the equations of motion, we also impose that the field operators are at every point in space and time self-adjoint or Hermitian. That will ensure that the expectation values are real and eigenvalues, if there are any. Okay, so all of this is now completely analogous to what we had in quantum mechanics. The commutation relations are just parallel to those of first quantization, and the equations of motion are actually quite similar to those of a harmonic oscillator. And the hermeticity condition, the realness condition of the field, becomes this hermeticity condition. By the way, let me make a little comment about something that we will see in much more detail later on, but you can perhaps already see it here. These two equations are the equations of motion and therefore the Klein-Gordon equation. They correspond, they're analogous to these two equations of the Schrödinger quantum mechanics, non-relativistic quantum mechanics. Q dot is P, and P dot is minus KQ. You see the similarity? It's phi dot is equal to minus something times phi. That's analogous to P dot is equal to minus and then something, let's just call it K, times Q. Now, when does that come up in ordinary quantum mechanics? In which circumstance are these the equations of motion? Well, this one, always. Right? Q dot is P. But this equation is particular. It's the equation of motion of a harmonic oscillator. Right? P dot is minus the back driving force constant K times the elongation. Right? So, no, P dot, that's the acceleration, right? So the acceleration is minus K times the elongation. That is the harmonic oscillator here. So structurally, we already see that in the case of quantum fields, we have a close analogy not only to first quantization, which was, of course, by design, but we also have a close analogy to the harmonic oscillator. It's not quite matching, though. And the reason is that this system of equations is a system of independent harmonic oscillators. For each degree of freedom, A, remember that A labels the various degrees of freedom, like the three coordinates of a particle, or maybe it labels the various particles. For each degree of freedom, we have another harmonic oscillator here. They are not coupled, right? You could excite one harmonic oscillator and the others will never know about it. They will just go about their business. Whatever you do with one harmonic oscillator cannot affect the others because the differential equations are completely decoupled. This equation contains only 1A, and that's just 1A. It's not the case that 1A gets mixed with the other, right? If there was a term that involved something like the A minus 1 or A plus 2 or whatever, then you would have a coupling between those harmonic oscillators. But no, they're independent. Not so here in the case of a quantum field. Here too we have P dot, which is like the acceleration, but it's the acceleration of the quark, right? How quickly does it go up and down? So here we have the acceleration of the quark at position x is equal to minus some constant times the elongation. So we certainly have this oscillation business going on of the quark, but that's not really a constant. That's not really a number. That is a number for the ordinary harmonic oscillator, but here, well, if that was absent, fine. Right? If this term was not there, let's just forget about this term for a moment, then yeah, it's fine. It's really just a harmonic oscillator, right? If this term was absent, then it would be strictly true that a quantum field is at every point x simply a harmonic oscillator. It's a harmonic oscillator where the back driving force is given by m squared. The m squared playing the role of this spring constant k, right? Would be easy. And it would be completely It would be correct to say that a quantum field is a quantum harmonic oscillator for every position x, and they are independent of another. Because, you know, this equation then contains only what goes on at x here and what goes on at x over there. doesn't know what happens at a different x. So this would be a situation of independent harmonic oscillators. We know that with waves on the lake, those oscillators are not independent. If you throw a stone in there, you're not just exciting the local oscillator. No, the local oscillator will excite its neighbors, and those neighbors will excite those neighbors, and before you know it, you have a wave phenomenon and it propagates. And the same is true for quantum fields. And why? Because of this term here. See, this term here contains derivatives with respect to space. And that means if you spell it out in terms of the Newton-Leibniz definition of what a derivative is, it means that this term here knows about the neighboring harmonic oscillators. Right? Because it takes the difference between phi at x plus epsilon minus phi of x, taking the limit x goes to 0. So that depends on the gradient of phi. And that is what makes the wave phenomenon happen, right? So the picture that I hope you take away from this lecture today is that quantum fields, just like classical fields, in fact, are local harmonic oscillators. At every point in x, there is a harmonic oscillator. And this is the spring constant. But those harmonic oscillators are coupled because of the second derivatives. If, for example, you adopt a model in which space is discrete, for example, if you put it on a computer, you may want to discretize space, then the Laplace operator becomes a finite difference operator. Because then you calculate derivatives the way that Newton and Leibniz did, but you don't take the limit for epsilon going to 0. And then you see how actually in this equation here on the right-hand side, you not only have phi of x, but you also have phi of x of the neighboring sides. In fact, even the next door neighbor, next to next door neighbor, because it's the second derivative here. All right, so this is how a quantum field is fundamentally structured. Harmonic oscillators everywhere, but these guys are coupled. Okay, and also another message was three things need to be solved: commutation relations, equations of motion, and hermeticity conditions. If we can solve the three, then we've solved the problem.
Why do we ask a field to be Hermitian? Why isn't it observable? In what sense is it an observable?
Oh, no, we are not asking that it's Hermitian because we want it to be observable. We are asking it to be Hermitian because we get away with it. It simplifies things, right? Mm-hmm. Because if we can do it for Hermitian, we can do it even for non-Hermitian ones.
Because Hermitian for operators is like real to complex, right?
Yeah. You can always decompose an operator into a Hermitian and anti-Hermitian part, apart from some functional analytic subtleties. That actually my work is a lot about those functional analytic subtleties, but for initial purposes, it's fine to just say that we can decompose any operator into a Hermitian and anti-Hermitian part. Okay, so then is there a Hamiltonian for second quantization? Right, so for this harmonic oscillator that we talked about, remember here these commutation relations and then those equations of motion, there is a Hamiltonian, and that Hamiltonian looks like this. This Hamiltonian generates the equations of motion that we just had here on the right-hand side for the first quantized analogous case. And that Hamiltonian is simply the sum of the Hamiltonians of independent harmonic oscillators. Right? Remember that here, we found that these equations of motion are very similar to these equations of motion for first quantization, right? Phi dot is pi, q dot is p, and then pi dot is this business, etc. And then we discussed that this k is a number, but here we have an operator. This creates the coupling and therefore the wave phenomena. This bunch of independent harmonic oscillators is described as a total system which has this total Hamiltonian. If you calculate the equations of motion for it, they are the equations of motion for a bunch of independent harmonic oscillators, where each of these harmonic oscillators is allowed to have a different frequency, like a Ka, right? And so omega A's. Now, is there, analogously, a Hamiltonian that we can write down in terms of phi and pi such that its equations of motion are these? So is there a Hamiltonian whose equations of motion give us the Klein-Gordon equation? And the answer is yes. Here it is. Hamiltonian is 1 half p squared plus 1 half phi squared with this thing in here, which would be just the spring constant if it were harmonic oscillators, right? It's the omega a squared for harmonic oscillators. But remember that the spring constant is more complicated for fields, and it turns out to be, you know, the spring constant here. I'm sorry that I'm switching between the k and the omegas, but this spring constant here is playing the role of that. And so similarly here, for quantum fields, we have this Hamiltonian here, where that is slightly non-trivial, right? We have phi m squared phi, that's easy enough, but here we have phi, and then Laplacian acting on phi. That's the Hamiltonian of the Klein-Gordon field. And what I mean by that is that the following proposition is true, namely, the proposition is that for this Hamiltonian, the Heisenberg equations of motion, namely these ones, the usual Heisenberg equations of motion, namely that the time derivative of an observable is equal to the commutator between the observable and the Hamiltonian, these equations of motion are the Klein-Gordon equation. I mean, are the two equations of motion, right? So the claim is that these two Heisenberg equations of motion, when you actually work it out, so you plug here this h into here and then work out the commutators, then those two equations of motion, those two Heisenberg equations are these two, which we know to be equivalent to the Klein-Gordon equation. So this is, in first quantization, that would be the analog. IH bar times the time derivative of some observable is the commutator between the observable and the Hamiltonian. If you do that for this harmonic oscillator sum for this system here, then you obtain these two equations of motion, which reduce exactly to these two equations of motion. If we do that for our quantum field and its proposed Hamiltonian, then we get this. Let's go through that together, and then as a homework, I suggest that you do the other case, right? So there is those two cases there. Let's do the first one, and then try yourself to prove this one. Okay, so what we do is we use the Heisenberg equation of motion, namely that IH bar phi dot is equal to the commutator of that observable, namely phi, with the Hamiltonian. And our aim is to work all of this out and find that it is indeed pi. Right? That was one of our equations of motion, namely that IH bar phi dot is equal to pi. And what you can do as a homework is to do this with the pi. So IH bar pi dot is equal to commutator of pi with h. And then you need to show that you get, as the right-hand side, this, right? So I'm showing you that this equation comes out. You can show that that equation comes out. So here's what we need for that. So phi dot is the commutator of phi with h, and that is just Heisenberg commutation relations. Now, we carry forward the phi, and we substitute in the h that was claimed to be the Hamiltonian for our theory. And this is the expression. You can see that I simplified it a little bit here. Okay. So the full Hamiltonian is this. Full Hamiltonian is 1/2 pi squared plus 1/2 phi something or other phi. Now you see, we need to commute, we need to calculate the commutator between phi and this. But you see, phi commutes with phi. And it's only containing phi and its space derivatives. They're all commuting with phi. Phi does not commute with its time derivative, because that's pi. But phi commutes with its space derivative. You can think of it this way. What is the space derivative? It's the phi here and the phi there. But phi commutes with itself anywhere, okay, at equal time. But not at different times, necessarily. Okay, so, therefore, I'm writing here that the, oh, this is the Heisenberg equation of motion, right? And then, in order to work out that commutator, we only need to commute the phi with this part of the Hamiltonian. This part contains only phi, so it clearly commutes with the phi. So all we have to do is calculate, so we can drop that term. All we need to do is calculate the commutator between phi and pi squared. Okay, so this is then 1/2 integral, and then the commutator of phi with pi, pi plus pi, pi. It's the usual way that you can work out the commutator of phi with the square of an operator. If you don't believe that formula, just plug it in, and you will see that you will get just that commutator back, right? Because there are a lot of terms that will cancel out in this way. The general formula that I'm using here is that when you have the commutator of A with B squared, then you can write that as B commutator of AB plus AB commutator with B, right? Doesn't matter what the individual things are. Okay, so that's what we have. The advantage of writing it in this seemingly more complicated way is that now we have commutators occurring that we know how to evaluate. We know that this is simply a Dirac delta, and that is simply a Dirac delta, but because that's the canonical commutation relations. So now we plug these expressions in here, of course, with the suitable prefactor of IH bar. And when you integrate, then in the last step, the remaining canonically conjugate momentum field over the Dirac delta, then, well, the Dirac delta simply fixes the x prime variable to become x, and the second term gives us the same thing, and we end up with concluding that it's just IH bar times pi, as it should be. With similar methods, you can prove the equation star, and that's the homework. Okay, that's it for today. Are there any questions? In the meantime, I'm switching this off.